recent years, you might wonder why in the world any company would want to become involved in decommissioning dead nuclear reactors. But then, consider decommissioning-obsessed Holtec International and the recently shuttered Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant in Massachusetts, and then you hear...
Companies like Holtec see that they can make a huge amount of money by decommissioning reactors, and that reactors across this country, many will be closing soon, so they can replicate the same at other reactors. They will get the decommissioning trust fund, their limited liability company, so they won't have to put a dime of their own into it. They anticipate making about $800 million at Pilgrim alone.
And that's what they get to walk away with no continuing responsibility. So when you hear something like that, it all begins to make a sick kind of sense as you realize that, once again and forever, you are in that uncomfortable seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, interview updates on three major U.S. stories. Piketon, Ohio, and the radiation contamination findings at the Zons Corner Middle School and the area surrounding the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant. We'll talk with whistleblower and longtime activist Vina Cowie. The outrageous Ohio bailout of two aging, failing nuclear reactors that guts state money for genuine renewables. Attorney Terry Lodge will weigh in on that story. And then we get to see more of the Holtec shenanigans, this time surrounding the now-shuttered Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station at the foot of Cape Cod. Mary Lampert of Pilgrim Watch and Diane Turco of Cape Downwinders will fill us in on that story. Remember, just because a nuclear reactor shuts down doesn't mean the problems are ever over. We will also have Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than Russia will ever let us know about their radioactive missile explosion. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 20th, 2019, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective.
Nuclear hot seat. Nuclear hot seat. Nuclear hot seat. Numbnuts of the Week.
What is it with nukes and alcohol? Last week's Numbnuts featured Chernobyl's atomic vodka, made from water and ingredients grown in the exclusion zone. This week, there's a small Dallas brewery called the Manhattan Project Beer Company that thinks it's oh so cute to have nuclear weapons-themed beers. Plutonium-239, based on the fuel used in the bomb that killed and injured an estimated 140,000 in Nagasaki. Nuclear Winter, an American stout. Tell me that's not ironic. Super Fortress, named after the B-29s that dropped atomic bombs in Japan. And a pilsner called Necessary Evil. Even Little Boy, with images of Hiroshima's destruction. And Hoppenheimer. You get it. But most outrageous of all is a beer called Bikini Atoll, which has sparked ire in the Marshall Islands and beyond. Bikini Atoll and neighboring Inuitok Atoll were two primary Pacific proving grounds in the Marshall Islands, where the United States tested 67 nuclear weapons between 1946 and 58, the equivalent of 1.6 Hiroshima-sized explosion every day for 12 years. Marshall Islands Secretary of Health and Human Services wrote, "Your product makes fun of a horrific situation. This is unacceptable to us." And Alex Wellerstein of Nuke Map fame wonders how people would react to a series of beer names based on a September 11 theme. And that's why, Manhattan Project Beer Company, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numb Nuts of the Week.
Here is this week's set of featured interviews. Because of nuclear anniversary and other special programs, I feel like there's been some catching up to do on various nuclear issues here in the United States and elsewhere. So this Nuclear Hot Seat is the first of a series of update programs, interviews with on-the-ground activists directly involved in some of the most pressing nuclear issues we face. First, we check in with Piketon, Ohio, where last May, the Zons Corner Middle School was closed and ultimately shut down for at least a year after enriched uranium was found inside the school and radioactive neptunium was found inside on the grounds with readings that went back to 2017 but were not revealed to the community. The source of this contamination is believed with great reason to be from the demolition of the Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant, less than 4 miles away from the middle school. To find out more and bring us up to date, we spoke again with Vina Colley. She is, in her own words, a sick worker from the Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant in Piketon, Ohio, and also a co-founder of National Nuclear Workers for Justice and Portsmouth-Piketon Residents for Environmental Safety and Security. As a whistleblower, Vina has spent decades fighting for transparency in all matters dealing with the uranium enrichment plant in Piketon. We spoke with her for Nuclear Hot Seat number 413 on May 21st, 2019, and this follow-up interview took place on Friday, August 16, 2019.
We last spoke for Nuclear Hot Seat number 413 on May 21st, and at that time, the Zons Corner Middle School was shut down because neptunium, americium, and enriched uranium were found either inside the school or on the ground. What has been happening since that time?
Well, since that time, the DOE came out at a public meeting, of course, and their findings were a little bit not ready to be come to the public because they didn't have all the answers on the radiation. So they held this public meeting, and they brought people in from Oak Ridge and Paducah and a lady from Oregon to talk about background radiation, and none of them talked about the Piketon facility. And there was a lady in the crowd said, "When you get all the results back on the radiation, will you then compensate the kids and take care of them and test them?" And the guy at the DOE, he said, "Well, we haven't got that far yet." So they had a complete meeting to help hold this public, having to come in and talk about something that they don't even have all the facts back yet. And I think they kind of wanted to flush out Dr. Ketterer so they could find out what his findings are. And so Dr. Ketterer had his meeting in Piketon, had a very good crowd turnout. He is really down to earth. He goes right to the basics, down to earth basics, where the lay people like me will understand what's going on at Piketon. And the one thing that he said that concerns me is that neptunium is in the Scioto River, which I knew they had caught fish and stuff in that river that was radioactive, but I never knew which isotopes was there. And he said that the neptunium is in the Scioto River. The Scioto River goes to the Ohio River, which goes all the way to the Mississippi. And all of this water is in our drinking tables. So now I'm very concerned because I live south of the plant and I'm not sure about our drinking water. I've always felt like the water was contaminated, but until you really hear someone like Dr. Ketterer tell you that your water has neptunium in it, but he's not real sure right now how far it has spread.
there seems to be a concerted effort on the part of DOE to bury or discredit his test results.
They discredit everybody. I mean, they've discredited me for 35 plus years, and they're trying to discredit him. But their findings, they didn't even have any findings when they had a meeting. I believe the way he did the testing, the way he did the samples, and the way he backs up his analysis, and he's even wanting to put a lab here in Pike County if this is what the community wants. We trust Dr. Ketterer better than we do the Department of Labor or anyone else.
Since this started happening and the word got out, the revelation was made about the radiation that was found in the school, there have been a number of class action suits filed. Where do those stand now?
They're still in the court. I guess they're waiting for the judge to certify them. And I'm sure there's probably going to be more lawsuits filed for long, too, with maybe even the workers. I'm not sure. I'm just hearing bits and pieces from different people and different workers. This is going to be a long of studies as they've done in the past for other facilities. And we really are against ATSDR and CDC coming in here because they came in here once before and they completely lied to the community about their findings and about our cancer analysis that we had. So we don't trust them. It's very concerning, and it's going to be a long, time-consuming process.
The size of the area for concern for radiation contamination has clearly increased. Initially, it was the four-mile radius that was represented by the Zons Corner Middle School, but it has grown. The last figure I read was a 12-mile radius. Is that still in effect, or has it grown beyond that?
Yes, it is a 12 mile is what I've said, but with this water in the Cider River being contaminated with neptunium, I believe it's going to be much further than 12 miles because the facility had direct pipes where they released contamination straight into the Scioto River from the facility. So all of these years with the chromium and the hexavalent and the chemicals and the radiation has been released into those pipes and straight into the Scioto River.
Have any changes been made to either increase the safety of the demolition going on to the Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant, or perhaps has it been paused given the level of response and concern from the local community?
I don't think anything's on hold. I think they're completely full steam ahead as far as I know, but that's just my opinion. I'm not really sure. Right now I haven't been out there for a few days. I try to stay away as much as I can, but I heard someone say they brought a big crane in. And I'm hoping that they do not go in there and try to take a crane like they've done these other facilities and bulldoze that 326 building down. And then they're also talking about a radiation study, and I believe that's on the Huntington Nickel plant that's been buried here since 1979. 79 truckloads from the Huntington Nickel plant in Huntington, West Virginia that got contaminated from Portsmouth and Paducah and Oak Ridge and had to be disassembled and buried out here in the ground. And I believe that by reading the documents, it is all already leaking off-site, and they want to dig that up and put it in one of the 12 waste cells that is at the plant. Their hope is to decommission this whole facility and do whatever they can to put it in the waste cell. And the waste cell is setting on top of fractured bedrock, which is sitting on top of the largest aquifer in the Midwest.
This is obviously a long-term, very concerning set of issues that have come up. What is next for you and the families and Dr. Ketterer in terms of facing down DOE and making your concerns known?
I think the community needs to stand behind him because I think, like all the rest of us, they tell people that we're not credible and we don't know what we're talking about. And I'm on this news site, local news site, Scioto County Daily News, and I have people on there attacking me all the time about not being credible or being a scam and people just after money. Well, they're not. Their kids have died of cancer, and there's a high rate of cancer in the community, and we're all concerned. We have a right to know the truth. And just like I told the DOE at the last meeting, I said 20 years ago, I asked you to come out and tell the community the truth. because we can't go forward and we can't make the decisions on what to do, that you've got us in this mess until you tell us the truth. I think that we're going to need more help, more coverage. The DOE needs to slow down that waste cell. They should not be. The waste cell land was contaminated with plutonium and neptunium. And according to this report, they are, where it's been raining, they're getting neptunium and plutonium in the wash-off from the cell. And back in 2002, Marvin Rezikoff, Mary Bird Davis, and myself did a report about plutonium being on that 300 and some acres of the east side of the facility, normally in the direction that the wind doesn't blow. So they knew the plutonium was there and the neptunium because they had a warning in 2002, but they ignored that warning. And these warnings came from the company documents. Everything that we have put into the public eye came from company documents. It's not something that we made up. It's something that the company put out, and we read their documents.
What company is this that you're referring to?
It started out with Goodyear Atomic, Martin Marietta Corporation, USEC, and who knows all the other names, but it's a DOE facility and a DOD facility because we did weapons-grade material for military production. So we have a tremendous problem here. I don't know the answers, but we need for them to come in and hold a community meeting and let us ask questions and give us answers.
I can only hope they provide that for you. Thank you, Vina, for this update. For now, thank you for being on Nuclear Hot Seat.
And thank you for getting the story out. It's a devastating story and a horrible story, what they've done to the children in the community here.
Was Vina Colley, founder of National Nuclear Workers for Justice and Portsmouth Piketon Residents for Environmental Safety and Security. We will stay in touch and bring you further updates as we get them. Next, we wanted to find out about the Byzantine manipulations going on around the Ohio State bailout of FirstEnergy's two aging nuclear reactors, Perry and Davis-Besse. The state, and I don't know what it is about Ohio and nuclear problems lately, but the state passed a bill that not only underwrites the failing nuclear facilities at a cost to taxpayers of, get this, $175 million a year, but it completely guts funding to solar and wind, genuine sources of renewable energy. Who better to discuss this with than Terry Lodge, an Ohio trial lawyer living in Toledo who has represented many clients in civil rights, civil liberties, and environmental cases, including this one. He has been an advocate for the public interest in energy policy issues, has litigated nuclear power safety and environmental issues for 40 years, and also represents opponents of nuclear weapons and mountaintop removal mining. We spoke on Friday, August 16, 2019.
When last we visited with Ohio House Bill 6, it was planned that this was going to be a bailout for the Perry and the Davis-Besse nuclear power stations. What happened?
Oh, a whole lot happened. A whole lot of people who were in denial, telling themselves that Republicans would never go for corporate welfare, were very wrong. FirstEnergy waged a $3.75 million lobbying campaign that included a lot of last-minute stocking stuffers in July.
What do you mean stocking stuffers?
I mean campaign donations.
Oh.
And this came after FirstEnergy had exercised a pretty vulgar hand in changing over the nature of the Republican composition of the General Assembly. Ohio's General Assembly has been nearly three-quarters Republican for going on a generation, well, at least 15 years, but a lot of the, I guess I would call them the more moderate Republicans, were unseated by, about seven or eight were unseated by candidates that were strongly supported financially by FirstEnergy last fall. So the composition changed, and it eked out a victory, but the victory was sealed by Democrats.
So what you're saying is that Democrats as well as Republicans voted for the bailout bill.
Yes, just enough. If one Democrat vote had gone against, it would have, at least for the time, frustrated the passage. The economics appear on paper to be simple, but this represents a tremendous regressive step. Beginning in 2021, residential ratepayers will start paying 85 cents a month for Davis Bessie and Perry to remain open, just a bare naked $150 million a year subsidy. Also, a little bit after that, I think the year after that, $1.50 a month will start being withheld from ratepayers, and that will go toward subsidizing the continued operation of about five coal burners, a couple of which were slated for closure because of the growth of both frack gas electrical generation as well as wind in Ohio. There's been a terrible, effectively a de facto wind freeze on wind development in Ohio for about 6 or 7 years based on a ridiculous, absurd setback requirement for large wind turbines that was imposed by the legislature, which has basically made it uneconomical for big wind developments to occur. So anyway, you have, in other words, a huge subsidy of coal and nuclear, and it is already triggering the termination of plans for fracked gas plants, and it effectively ensures that there will be no solar or further wind development until at least 2027. So all of the investment oxygen gets sucked out of the room for alternatives and renewables. But another thing we've lost is the legislature in House Bill 6 junked a 10-year-old, highly productive but very low-key energy conservation portfolio requirement. And presently, ratepayers have about $4.75 withheld or paid through their rates per month. And the net effect of that has been to generate energy conservation subsidies of all sorts, not just to residential users, but has generated about five times the energy conservation savings that otherwise would have taken place with normal market effects. So this is all being marketed as a net savings to electrical customers of about $3.75 a month by the late 2020s. But it's actually a very unfortunate and regressive development. And from the standpoint of being an anti-nuclear activist for more than 40 years, what really troubles me is that Davis Bessie has a hideous and at times shameful operating and safety record. Perry is somewhat younger and has not had as many high visibility, high profile incidents, but both of them are aging plants. Davis Bessie in particular is quite troublesome. And what we think is really the agenda here, and I'm rather confident that it's going to play out this way. First Energy is in the process of washing through bankruptcy, and they have segregated, they've basically taken all their coal and nuclear plants and dumped them in a, left them in a corporate shell that has no other assets. So you have dinosaur plants held by a corporate entity that is probably going to sell them off. I don't know if the coal burners will go anywhere, but the nuclear plants are likely to be bought up by a large firm such as Energy or Exelon. And those types of firms have a reputation that is rather noticeable of running nukes into the ground. Something else that has happened in conjunction with all this is that First Energy has petitioned successfully the NRC in the last, let's say, 8 to 12 months for waivers on several different types of safety measures that otherwise would be required. You have aging plants, and you would think that the breakdown potential and the rust and corrosion potential and all that would heighten the need for inspections. But in fact, the NRC has rolled back a number of requirements, and they did so based upon the First Energy ownership notifying the NRC that they intended to shut down both of these nukes within a couple of years if they didn't get the bailout. So the NRC acting on the, or relying, I suppose, on the proposition that these plants are going to be closed shortly, granted waivers of inspection frequency, for example, or replacement of major components, for example, on the basis that, oh, they're going to be closing in a couple of years anyway, why impose the burden, an additional economic hardship? The problem is that now that FirstEnergy is assuring the public that they are going to continue to operate both those nukes, the NRC has not rescinded the waivers. And it would be a very difficult process for citizens to petition, and probably a futile process for citizens to petition the Nuclear Regulatory to undo the waivers it granted. So what you have is this incredible scenario where the plants will remain open come hell or high water because of subsidies that are just direct handovers of cash, and they also will be a good investment if you're a large aging nuclear plant buying firm, because there will be deregulated atmosphere surrounding their operation.
Is there any way that the NRC can be pressured or instigated or in some way rescind those without having to have huge pressure from the public, which you say is pretty futile?
No, not that I know of. And part of it is that the NRC is largely unresponsive to political requests. And the problem also is that the Ohio congressional delegation, once Dennis Kucinich was dislodged from office, there's not been any particularly outspoken anti-nuclear fervor in the Ohio delegation anyway. So no, I don't see it happening.
What, if any, pushback has been happening to this bailout?
Well, there was enormous citizen lobbying against the bailout. A somewhat disturbing Strange Bedfellows partnership emerged of people ranging from environmentalists and anti-nuclear activists to sort of Sierra Club environmental moderates to oil and gas industry, fracking industry, power generators, and of course the burgeoning in other states than Ohio wind industry and photovoltaic solar, as well as large users of electricity who were fearful that a bailout would impose fixed rates on them and diminish their ability to negotiate sweet deals. I'm talking about institutional users like hospitals and mental health facilities, that kind of thing, and also large-scale industrial users like Walmart. So it's an interesting coalition that certainly included a lot of mainstream players, and they were certainly pouring money, I'm sure, into advertising and even campaign contributions, but they were unable to make the cut. Another big loser in this, which very interestingly and somewhat ironically, is construction trades benefit from retooling and refueling of large centralized power plants like nukes and coal. And so the construction trades were always on the side of the bailouts. And that, in fact, is what swayed the small number of Democrats who crossed over. And literally, the day after the bill passed and was signed into law in the bankruptcy case, FirstEnergy files motions to basically terminate the existing union contracts and renegotiate them, and have publicly stated that because of the bankrupt condition of the company, that there will have to be significant pension and even hourly compensation changes made. As though that weren't foreseeable.
My jaw is dropping at the manipulation and the planning that went into this job of screwing the people of Ohio, and heaven help us far beyond should anything serious go wrong at either one of those nukes.
Yes.
Where does this go from here?
Well, the battle is not over. Pretty much the same coalition of opponents is attempting to circulate petitions for a referendum, a statewide referendum vote. Incidentally, one thing I wanted to stress is, so the two nukes serve northern third of Ohio, but the entire customer base of the state of Ohio will be paying into the bailouts, which I find to be just incredible. But to get beyond that. So there is going to be an attempt to put a referendum on the ballot, but there is a legal challenge, unsurprisingly, lodged by First Energy claiming, and this is such a hypocritical hoax type of legal argument, they're claiming that the bailout terms comprise a tax, and if they are recognized as a tax, they are exempt from being referred to the public for a statewide public up or down vote. And they base pretty much their entire argument on one of the opposition experts, who was an economist, who said it was like a tax, but legally speaking, didn't fit all of the characteristics of one. It's actually a very common form of legislative rate making. Legislature imposes rate terms on the Public Utilities Commission and says, enforce them. And that's basically what it is. It's certainly not a tax. But the judicial politics of the Ohio Supreme Court are pretty iffy, and, up may yet be down. 2 + 2 might yet equal 5 in Ohio.
What, if anything, can be done to assist you in the pushback for those who are listening and are as outraged as I am right now?
Number one, be vigilant for bailouts in your own states. Ohio is about the fifth or sixth one that has seen some outrageous set of terms effectively just imposed. It is by far the most comprehensive and discouraging sign yet. If you're in Ohio, incidentally, the referendum movement will have 90 days to gather probably something on the order of about 400,000 signatures that have to be allocated in certain percentages from certain numbers of counties according to population, stuff like that. It's a difficult thing to envision that they will be successful, even though the oil and gas industry is rumored to be capitalizing, paying petition circulators. So if you're not in Ohio, be vigilant about this sort of thing being replicated in your state. There's some evidence that suggests that the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a corporate front that does copycat legislation from state to state, was behind this, that Ohio was quite the test case where you include lots of moving parts, not just a subsidy, but something that guts renewables. And of course, ALEC is renowned for being Koch Brothers, K-O-C-H Brothers, funded to a considerable extent. And the other thing is for people to get the understanding that the new watchwords for nuclear bailouts are that this is our clean bridge energy to survive the repercussions from climate chaos. So you have these 40 and 45-year-old rust buckets with troublesome histories that are now being pointed to and advertised and bandied about as our saviors.
Unbelievable. Unfortunately real. So unbelievable.
And very, very real.
Anything you want to add?
I think that this is another one of those very highly charged fronts on the entire climate chaos versus climate chaos denial war front, and that we all know that nuclear isn't going to save us, and new nuclear has zero role in the future. And movements like First Energy's incredibly high-handed, very visible buying of the best legislature that money could buy is discouraging because they, as I say, have taken most of the oxygen out of the room for financing the utterly necessary transition that we have to make and make yesterday.
Ohio trial lawyer Terry Lodge. We'll continue with this week's update on nuclear issues around the United States. But first, the pro-nuclear propaganda just keeps coming, thick and fast, setting up and manipulating talking points that the casual reader, or legislator, or reporter will catch in headlines and absorb as gospel truth when it's really just the opposite. What is there to counter the lies of the nuclear industry, all of their money and influence and smug, smarmy talking points? Nuclear Hot Seat. For going on 9 years, Nuclear Hot Seat has been one of the only places where you can reliably get a one-hour hit of honest, non-hysterical nuclear information every week. We got your interviews with activists, with genuine experts, roundup of international news. Never enough time for all the stories. We've got numbnuts so you can at least giggle a little bit. Bad puns, sometimes a touch of musical theater. Where else can you find all this in a weekly counterbalance to nuclear industry lies? Of course, this show has been operating for years on a budget that's less than what one nuclear lobbyist pays for one dinner with powerful legislators. And that budget is dependent on you, the listeners, to keep us going. So if you're against nukes and want to help get the word out, help us with a donation. We make it easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button. That's how you can send a one-time donation or set up a monthly donation of any size. And to send us a monthly $5, the same as a cup of coffee and a good tip here in the United States, just click on the big green donate button at nuclearhotseat.com. Please do what you can now and know that the help that you're giving makes a difference, and it makes me deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now, back to this week's update on U.S. nuclear issues, at least some of them. It wasn't so long ago that we were celebrating the shutdown of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth, Massachusetts, located at the foot of Cape Cod. That was for Nuclear Hot Seat number 415 on June 4th, 2019. So here we are, only 2.5 months later, and the nuclear nightmare that is Plymouth continues in a morphed form. Two reports. First, Mary Lampert, founder of Pilgrim Watch, with whom we spoke on Monday, August 19, 2019.
Mary Lampert, when last we spoke, Pilgrim was being shut down, and that was terrific news, and everybody was happy. But while that ended a chapter, it has obviously not ended the story. What has happened since then?
Entergy, the owner of Pilgrim, decided to sell the plant, to try to sell it, to a company to do the decommissioning. Whatever company would buy Pilgrim would get the decommissioning trust fund to do the job. That fund is worth $1.3 billion. And so Holtec jumped at the chance to purchase Pilgrim. They had an agreement with Entergy that they would pay approximately $1,000 for the site.
Excuse me, just $1,000 for the nuclear reactor and the physical site?
And for the 1,600 acres, yes, that's correct. However, it gets the monkey off of Entergy, the current licensee's back, because they've had it with trying to operate nuclear reactor in a competitive environment. They were losing money, and they want to get on to doing other more lucrative businesses. Companies like Holtec see that they can make a huge amount of money by decommissioning reactors, and that reactors across this country, many will be closing soon, so they can replicate the same at other reactors. They will get, as I said, the decommissioning trust fund, their limited liability company, so they won't have to put a dime of their own into it. They anticipate making about $800 million at Pilgrim alone in the deal. How can they make that amount of money? It's very simple. They plan to take about 30% profit from the decommissioning trust fund for taking charge of the decommissioning. That would yield them about $300 million and change. Furthermore, they will be charged with, so to speak, babysitting the spent fuel until it can leave the site. Any associated spent fuel management costs, they can sue the Department of Energy for for breach of contract for not taking the spent fuel off-site by 1998 as promised. So judging from their cost estimates for babysitting the fuel at Pilgrim, they would then receive back $500 million. Now, all those spent fuel management costs, they never put a nickel into, nor did Entergy. Those were part of the decommissioning trust fund that citizens in Massachusetts put that money up when Pilgrim was built. Neither Entergy nor Holtec put a dime into it. They get to use the decommissioning trust fund for all spent fuel management costs, and in turn, they get to sue DOE and recoup that $500 million and put it in their own pocket because NRC does not require that money to go back to refurbish the decommissioning trust fund.
That's insane.
Well, I think it's insane. This is why it's a gold rush. That is why Holtec, that has never decommissioned a reactor before, has put in to decommission Pilgrim. They started on Oyster Creek in New Jersey. They put in to decommission three units at Indian Point, New York, and Palisades. At the same time, another company, Northstar, has taken over Vermont Yankee, and they'll reap huge benefits there, but not as much as Holtec will reap here, because the state of Vermont was able, because of their unique situation where the state had to approve the sale to Northstar, got to put in conditions that any monies received from DOE would go back into the decommissioning trust fund. But not the case here. I do not believe it's the case in New York, not in New Jersey, not in Michigan. This is a huge amount of money, but it's interesting that Holtec has a reputation of lying recently to the state of New Jersey. They were banned at TVA for, I would say, malpractice with a whistleblower suit. They have definite reputation of malfeasance, but not as much as a company from Canada that they are partnering with to do much of the decommissioning work, SNC-Lavalin Company, that has Trudeau and hot water up in Canada and has a long history of malfeasance, lying, bribery, underestimating costs, dumping radioactive waste in the basements and cleaning up a site in Canada right beside a river. And it goes on and on, being sent to jail around the world and having been listed by the World Bank as the most corrupt international company. And the World Bank said SNC-Lavalin couldn't bid on any project that the bank was funding. And there is movement in Canada to prohibit SNC-Lavalin from bidding on Canadian projects. And so what we have are two companies with very questionable character that would be coming into Plymouth. And that, among other reasons, is why the Massachusetts Attorney General and Pilgrim Watch both filed contentions to intervene in the licensing transfer process. Both the Attorney General and Pilgrim Watch filed contentions that met all the qualifications for acceptance. We both filed that the license transfer agreement did not indicate sufficient funds to do the job, leaving most likely the Commonwealth holding the bag, nor did they guarantee that they would do a site environmental assessment at the beginning of the project, which is requisite for estimating costs and also preventing radioactive and hazardous material that may be near the shore already of Cape Cod Bay getting into Cape Cod Bay before the job is completed. And Pilgrim Watch filed a third contention saying, we need to see that the NRC has taken into account the character or lack of character of Holtec and SNC-Lavalin to take over the license, because it was brought up in New Jersey, the malfeasance of those two companies, and the NRC said, we don't consider character.
Well, that's clear here in Southern California, because Holtec has been just whipping the community around over the problems at San Onofre, saying there are no problems at San Onofre, and the NRC just signed off on them continuing to unload extremely thin canisters right butt up against the ocean, with each one of these canisters contains a Chernobyl's worth of radiation. Now, I can go on that, but let's keep the focus on Pilgrim for now.
And so the NRC staff last week recommended to the NRC commission to go ahead and approve the license transfer request, despite the fact that neither the Attorney General's or Pilgrim Watch contentions have elicited a response from the NRC.
Is that a legal requirement that they at least respond?
They are throwing in the face their own procedures. And one could say, if the NRC doesn't follow its own procedures, how do you expect any licensee to follow its procedures? However, the NRC Commission has yet to rule whether they will accept the NRC staff's recommendation to approve. And therefore, both the Attorney General and Pilgrim Watch requested the commissioners to issue a stay in the proceedings until they have taken up the contentions of the AG and Pilgrim Watch. And we wanted and requested 5 days from the time they would take a vote to send in motions of why they should not approve that until they have heard our contentions and followed their own procedure. The NRC staff lamely said, well, we'll just go ahead, you see, that's what we recommend, and then if the AG and Pilgrim Watch continue, and anything comes up of merit, then we can always amend the license. Well, fat chance that would happen.
Right.
And so that's where we stand at this very moment. Senator Markey wrote to the commissioners and said, don't do it. Don't approve without following your proper procedures. The town of Duxbury will be doing the same, and others. And I understand a group is organizing a protest. So we'll see what happens.
What can those of us who are at distance from Pilgrim in Massachusetts and this issue do to support you?
Do what Congressman Markey did. Write email the NRC commissioners and saying this is wrong. Follow your own procedures. And your procedures are to accept contentions that are properly formulated, go through that hearing process, and then move forward from there. And the mere thought that NRC is going around the country gathering from an order from Congress to look at how the public can participate more in the decommissioning process is a fraud. If the NRC staff is recommending ignoring the Attorney General of Massachusetts and a public interest group, then what are these hearings all about? The suggested time frame from filing contentions was that in 45 days, the NRC would respond whether they were accepting the contentions, which ones not, setting a hearing dates and a schedule. We haven't heard word, not a word. And these were filed in February. Not a word.
Mary, this is obviously going to be a long-term battle, a continuing long-term battle, not that it hasn't been that already. And I look forward to being able to speak with you, hopefully with getting better news, but to stay in touch and stay on top of what's happening at Pilgrim, because it seems to be a potential role model for how decommissioning is going to be handled elsewhere in the country. And we don't want this one getting away from us.
You bet.
Mary Lampert of Pilgrim Watch. To get a more on-the-ground sense of local citizens' response to the ongoing Pilgrim power play by Holtec and SNC-Lavalin, I spoke briefly with Diane Turco of Cape Downwinders. She brought some new perspectives to the issues with her customary passion and fire.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is totally captured by the industry. There was no reason why they could not have waited 90 days to have a hearing on these issues, but they're rushing it through. So we are actually saying, you know, the Energy Reorganization Act of 1974 abolished the Atomic Energy Commission, which ushered in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And now we're saying, you know what, it's time now for the NRC to be abolished also and be replaced with the authority of federal and state officials, an intergovernmental agency independent of the nuclear industry, also including representation by state and local reps that really look at making decisions based on public health and safety and not the industry bottom line. It's got to stop.
What kind of pushback has been coming from Cape Downwinders and the other groups most directly involved in this?
Well, we have been working along with the Attorney General's office. We've been in touch for years with them. So we have been following all of their work. And then Pilgrim Watch has also submitted a petition. So we're out there. We are writing our letters to our elected officials. Actually, we are going to have a demonstration over the highway in Plymouth tomorrow. We will be standing over the highway at exit 9 over Route 3 to call attention to what is happening with this license transfer to Holtec. We'll be holding signs, halt Holtec, meet AGO demands, Attorney General Office demands. We need to be out on the streets to be present and make it known that there is resistance and we do not consent to the decisions that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is making. So we're hoping to get some press and show that there is resistance to this nonsense.
It's unconscionable to me how this one company has suddenly mushroomed up and is snapping up old nuclear reactors as though it's some kind of a growth industry, with their guarantees that they can decommission faster and cheaper. And the two things you don't want to do in decommissioning a nuclear reactor is be fast and cheap. You want it to be slow, thorough, and appropriate. And as we know from our dealings here on the West Coast with San Onofre, with Holtec, they are not to be trusted.
Exactly. Joy Russell, who's a VP for Holtec, was at a decommissioning meeting here in Plymouth. She had said that Holtec has a, quote, impeccable safety record, unquote. So when it was public meeting time, I said, so, tell us about San Onofre. Ha ha! And there was silence. Silence. And they also came to Plymouth and said, we will be open and transparent. We want to work together. And it's just been the opposite. They won't speak with the NDCAP. They won't answer questions to Plymouth. And yet they apply for exemptions, the use of the decommissioning trust fund, to the NRC. So they're communicating well with the NRC and getting exactly what they want. But when it comes to the state and local people asking for information regarding public health and safety, the response is silence. Senator Markey did write a letter asking for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to wait until the contentions are dealt with. So we're just hoping, and we trust Maura Healey is fabulous, and she's so on. Our Attorney General really gets this issue, and her office is working very hard. So we're supporting their efforts and hoping that, you know, the right thing comes out.
Diane Turco of Cape Downwinders. That's catching you up on three nuclear informational hotspots, but there are many other stories, too, including Rocky Flats and so much more. And we will endeavor to do update interviews on those in the coming weeks. Activist shout-out! Catching up with a protest at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories that took place on Tuesday, August 6th, to remember the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki 74 years ago. It resulted in 42 arrests. Just over 100 people turned out for the annual rally, organized by Livermore-based Tri-Valley Cares, dubbed the Designing Armageddon at Livermore Lab Peace Rally. The event began at 8 a.m. and was followed by a march to the lab's west gate, where a traditional Japanese dance called in the ancestors and the outlining of bodies on pavement to commemorate the vaporized shadows found after the atomic bombings. The Tri-Valley Cares press release stated, "It is imperative to gather at Livermore Lab on the date a nuclear weapon was first used in war to stop the creation of new warheads proposed by President Trump." Daniel Ellsberg, an activist best known for his release of the Pentagon Papers in 1971 and author of The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, was the rally's keynote speaker. Well done, all. Here's today's final thought. I'm tired of thinking. I'm going off to watch a G-rated movie. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 20th, 2019. Hey, we've got some big news here. There are major changes coming to Nuclear Hot Seat. Now, don't worry, we're not going away. Just the opposite. We're just getting bigger, better, and stronger. First step, Nuclear Hot Seat is now available on all your favorite podcast platforms, Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play. So however you prefer to listen to your podcast, you will find us there. You can even click through to them at tabs at the top of the website landing page. And if there's a platform that you use and we've missed, let us know and we will load it up there as well. And a big shout out to broadcast station KNIZ 90.1 in Gallup, New Mexico, which has become the latest broadcast station to cover Nuclear Hot Seat every week. Thanks to all of you for listening and joining with Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers around the world, in 123 countries on 6 continents and counting. And if you know of a radio station in your area that would be interested in joining the growing network of broadcast affiliates carrying Nuclear Hot Seat, contact me with their info or have them contact us by sending an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, use that email as well. Send the information to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And a reminder that if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com. We will really appreciate your support. Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that when it comes to nuclear, not only what you don't know can hurt you, the chances are it probably already has. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So please don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the Nuclear Hot Seat.
Nuclear Hot Seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear Hot Seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.
as Tim Gibson, and I am the host of Anti-Medium Radio for UCY.TV.